Good morning, I'm Susan Ormiston, and you're listening to the Friday edition of The Current. Life and death on the planet of the slums. Earlier this week, Anna Maria Tremonti took us into the shanty towns surrounding Buenos Aires, and Avro Benoit told us about the harsh realities of living in a Mumbai slum. It was part of The Current's global take on what makes cities work. And yesterday, we tried to apply some of those lessons to Canadian cities. A lot of that conversation focused on the difficult questions of how and where to house the steady influx of people into the cities. Outside Canada, the answer for many cities is the slum. Because tragically, slums are the only form of housing that seems to be keeping up with demand. Mike Davis has been studying housing patterns for years and has just published a new book called Planet of the Slums. He joins me from San Diego. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's start with the basic numbers, Mike. The UN estimates there are 1 billion people living in slums around the world. Where are these slums primarily?
Well, first of all, the UN estimates, should be pointed out, are very conservative estimates. The UN estimates that there are probably less than half the number of slum dwellers in Mexico that Mexicans would estimate there are. The geographical breakdown is about 7% of the population of the OECD bloc, Northern Europe and North America, live in slums. 3/4 of the population of Africa live in slums. Some countries have almost science fiction levels of slum populations. 99% of urban Ethiopians live in slums by the conservative standards of the United Nations.
So how are you describing slums? I mean, we've heard of townships and shanty towns. What are the common characteristics?
Well, the definition is the one used by the United Nations in this landmark report, The Challenge of Slums, that was published 3 years ago. And it's the first serious study of urban poverty on a world scale. And the UN's definition of a slum is substandard or poor housing, overcrowding, lack of basic services and hookups, including electricity and water and sanitation. The actual number of poor people, urban poor people in the world, is much larger. And in some cities, actually, the majority of the poor don't live in slums.
Now, you're saying that 3/4 of Africans are identified as living in slums. What are the sanitation issues for them, for example? How bad is it?
Well, the sanitation issues are desperate, and the pollution of water supply by human and animal waste, of course, is directly responsible for the death of several million children a year in Africa and South Asia, especially the slums of Nairobi or huge vast areas of Lagos and Kinshasa, have no access to privies, or in some cases they're privatized and far too expensive for poor people to afford.
The toilets are privatized?
Yes, this is a new major cash point in the neoliberal world economy, which is privatizing public privies and having companies that come in and then, take a few pennies from you every time you need to use the loo, which means a lot of people, of course, can't afford to do that because they have to save the money for food or transportation. The solution in large parts of urban Africa is simply to use plastic bags. In Nairobi, once they're filled, they're often just thrown outside or into somebody else's yard, and they're referred to as scud missiles.
Now, you've characterized the size of the slums, but what I'm most interested in, quite frankly, Mike, is how much they're growing. I mean, is this something that is under control, or is this something that's growing out of control?
No, this is the major conclusion of the UN study, and it's important to preface this by saying that before the UN did this study, which is based on new kinds of statistics and the use of household surveys, it's the first really scientific view of urban poverty. Before that, there was simply speculation and guesswork. Now we know that from this point onward, all the future increase in the world population will occur in cities. About 95% of that will occur in cities of the third world, cities of the South, and probably about half of that or more will contribute to the growth of slums. If there are a billion slum dwellers today, there will be 2 billion in another 15 years.
Now, why are these people coming into these cities if the conditions are that poor? Why aren't they staying where they are?
Well, this is one of the profound facts of our time. It's simply the conditions that enforces that expel people or push them out of the countryside are more powerful than the forces that draw people into the city. So you could have African cities growing very rapidly during the 1980s when urban economies were in recession or depression, were actually shedding formal sector jobs, viciously cutting their public sectors down. So people aren't coming to cities just for jobs. They're coming because they're expelled from the countryside by agricultural modernization, by the competition of agricultural exports. And they come to the city not because there are formal jobs waiting for them in factories or offices, but because they calculate that survival opportunities are marginally better in the city than in the countryside. So in a way, the crisis of the city is rooted in a more profound crisis, and that's the crisis of the global countryside.
So are the conditions for them slightly better in these slums compared to where they were?
It's really hard to understand how many poor people survive in cities. For the last 20 or 25 years, there's been this belief that the poor, in a sense, create their own future, that they find free land, they squat, they develop little shacks, which later grow into substantial homes. If they can't find jobs in the formal economy, they work as vendors or laborers or nannies and eventually, you know, lift themselves up by their bootstraps. But probably the most important conclusion of my book, which is based on the work of literally hundreds of researchers in different countries, is one that the supply of squatable free land has disappeared. That when people come to the city now, they're either renters or they're forced to buy their little plots from someone. And that secondly, the informal economy, which is a world of also more than a billion people across the earth, is now congested and overpopulated with people competing for the same kinds of jobs and survival niches, thus lowering the, you know, the income and opportunity for everyone else. So in a sense, the kind of frontier of free land and the opportunities of survival and formal employment seem to be coming to a crisis point in a number of cities or countries across the world.
Where would you say that's happening already?
The whole coast of West Africa, basically from Ghana to Nigeria, is one of the most rapidly urbanizing places in the world. It's expected that in a decade there'll be 60 million people living in cities there. And it's clear in West Africa, it's also clear in East Africa, and of course in places like Kinshasa, that you really are running out of survival niches, and it's unclear how people will cope. The extreme example is the capital of Congo, Zaire, Kinshasa, which is a great city of almost 8 million people, in which probably 90%, maybe 95% of its inhabitants eke their living in the informal sector. The state's relationship to the population is basically that of a predator. People have ruralized the city by planting crops wherever they can. This would be a very desperate and tragic future for the urban third world to see more Kinshasas.
And what risk is there of that? I mean, you talk about that corridor you mentioned as the biggest continuous urban footprint of poverty on Earth. It's stunning, really, in size, 60 million people. How many cities are at risk of becoming one big slum where, you know, that population far exceeds the population of people who are actually making an income and surviving?
Well, this is everywhere possible in sub-Saharan Africa, even in industrialized and relatively wealthy South Africa. It's true still in much of South Asia. Even miracle cities like Hyderabad in India, with its California-like suburbs and its tens of thousands of returned software engineers from California. I mean, really the center of what's called India Shining is surrounded by immense slums. There are far more street children and rag pickers and beggars in Hyderabad than there are geeks or software engineers. So even the cities of the South that have shown a lot of economic dynamism are held up as examples to the rest of the developing world, have crushing problems of slum poverty, which are rooted finally in the whole question of unemployment. And I argue in my book that urban unemployment is as fundamental a challenge to the future of humanity as global warming.
Yeah, you can see how that would come about. I want to get into some of those issues in a second, but I want to address how this happened. You mention in your book that international bodies such as the IMF and the World Bank have helped contribute to the growing problem. Why is that?
Well, because first of all, in the 1970s, poor countries, developing countries, were pressured and urged to borrow as much as possible, particularly to expand their extractive and export industries. And then prices for those commodities crashed, countries that overborrowed. And the whole burden in that, of course, was shifted to the poorest parts of their population. And to a very great degree, during the 1980s, the decade of debt in which whole continents like South Africa lost a generation of growth, where incomes and growth declined. Much of the pain of that was concentrated on the cities, and particularly in the urban public sector. It's just decimated public employment, decimated health services for the poor. Cities continued to grow, and in many cases at extraordinary velocity, but there was no counterpart investment in urban infrastructure and schools or healthcare.
Because
the formula, the recipe that the IMF and the World Bank is the long-term caretaker of debt imposed on these countries was radical shrinkage of public investment, of investment in cities. And with that, you saw a collapse in formal employment and instead a growth in this survival-oriented informal employment. Lots of people, you know, vending in the streets or scraping by as domestics. And then in the 1990s, you've seen rampant deindustrialization in the great cities of the South. Everybody thinks that, of course, manufacturing jobs are being shifted from places like Ontario to the Third World, but they're largely being shifted, if they are, to southern China, to some extent, to India. But the cities that were once the great industrial cities of the Third World, offering manufacturing jobs to immigrants from the countryside, places like Bombay, Mumbai, Buenos Aires, Sao Paulo, Belo Horizonte, have all suffered deindustrialization of a scale familiar in the United States or England or Spain. I mean, in other words, the number of industrial jobs has been cut in half at the same time that these cities continue to grow very, very rapidly.
How much of it is also a problem of too many people?
If you look at the real carrying capacity of the Earth, this isn't too much. The problem is that cities, which should be the salvation, the ark for world population, because cities, in theory at least, are more environmentally efficient than any other arrangement we've invented for living, cities aren't realizing their environmental economies or capacity. One of the things that's happening in poor cities is sprawling growth and poverty are consuming the environmental reserves, the watersheds that are essential for cities to function efficiently in an environmental sense. Sprawl, which we usually think of as a problem of wealthy North American cities, is exponentially greater problem in the Third World. Most of the poor who are now coming to the cities don't settle in traditional inner city slums. They settle far in the periphery, sometimes 30 or 40 miles from the center of the city. Cities in the Third World have grown at velocities far exceeding that seen in the 19th century. China alone, in one decade, in the 1980s, added more people to its cities than did all of Europe, including Russia, in the entire 19th century.
If you suggest that it isn't a problem of overpopulation, it is a problem of unemployment and poverty, the slums, as you've described them, have grown exponentially in the last decade, and the jobs aren't going to reappear in those cities. So I'm left wondering what to do. What is the solution here?
Well, I wouldn't agree that the jobs won't reappear. It's essential not to be unduly pessimistic about the potentials to, you know, create jobs and futures for for poor people. What's happened in the last 20 or 30 years has been an almost total abdication of responsibility for things like urban housing and employment by local states. And this is one of the legacies of debt and now one of the kind of dogmas of neoliberalism, that the state should get out of these things and let the private sector do it. But the market isn't creating these jobs, or it's not creating the level of housing to address need. The state has to come back in, but it has to be a different kind of state. And one of the most fundamental problems in cities of the South of the Third World is the lack of local democracy. So many cities, you can't actually vote for your city government, or if you can now, like only recently, for instance, inhabitants of Mexico City have been allowed to vote for the mayor. But if you do vote for a mayor or a city council, local government, they don't have access to the resources or control on the resources. And many cities, you have industrial development authorities and so on that are set up beyond the reach of the popular vote. So the great need, the desperate need, is for more democracy and control on a local scale, and for the vote to confer some access or power over the use of social resources. Cities in the South suffer from the most regressive taxation in the world. In some large cities, the middle classes hardly pay taxes at all. They escape almost entirely the burden of paying for urban infrastructure. So the solution, in part, has to be a democratic revolution.
Are you seeing that anywhere?
The grassroots.
I mean, Latin America, for example, there has been some mobilization by people living in slums making demands. Is that part of the solution?
Indeed, it is. And although you see an enormous variety of ideologies and alternatives in the slums of the world, there's no way you can make a single generalization or characterization, people turning everywhere from the Holy Ghost and Muhammad to street gangs and ethnic militias to revolutionary groups. Still, you see examples of what a viable future would look like, where slum dwellers take control over their own destinies and demand redistributive justice. I think the most exciting examples are, for instance, in Bolivia, where El Alto, which is the immense Indian-speaking slum that is in the mountain above La Paz, the capital, have created a dynamic social movement, at times even blockaded the city in order to make demands for greater resources, infrastructure. In the case of Venezuela, whatever people think of the President Chavez, there is enormous dynamism in the slums of Caracas. Very, very interesting experiments going on, particularly because now the poor have some access to their national oil revenue. Perhaps what's most unusual about the current situation is now these movements can talk to each other. People in slums and poor neighborhoods across the world fighting for improvement, fighting for local democracy, now can talk to each other over the internet, through world social summits, and this has created a kind of global awareness of a shared condition.
What I'm looking for, and because I was in South Africa last week and visited mm-hmm. Khayelitsha and the urban slum, the township surrounding Cape Town, growing incredibly, and what I was struck by was how the social fabric of that community is very rich. You know, what people don't realize who don't visit them is that there are barbers, there are markets, there are dance halls, there are daycares, there are people coming and going. Yes, there's crime and immense poverty and sanitation and electricity are issues. But I was asking myself, what does this community, Khayelitsha, look like in the future in an ideal situation? They can't possibly move all those people, perhaps as many as a million, from that space. Does it look like? Does it look like, concrete homes instead of shacks? Is that better?
No, I mean, I think the solution in some ways is clear. For 20 or 30 years, there's been worldwide experimentation and self-building, providing resources for slum dwellers to improve their own, not only their own individual dwellings, but to create community fabric and develop infrastructure. And to some extent, this has been supported by groups like the World Bank, but it's been enormously underfunded. It's taken largely the form of philanthropy and overseas aid. What you need to do is to connect the enormous creativity of people and their desire to improve their cities and their neighborhoods with the resources that can bring about really significant improvement at the kind of macro level in urban life. And almost everywhere, this has to involve some redistribution of income. At the end of the day, you have to actually begin to shift some of the wealth and income of society from the gated middle class suburbs to the inner cities and the outer slum belts. But there's no question that people are capable, by themselves and through locally controlled NGOs and government, of doing fantastic things in their neighborhoods. It's getting the resources.
You write of these gigantic cities which are on our doorstep. I mean, estimates of Mumbai, for example, of attaining a population of 33 million people. And you ask the question whether these gigantic concentrations are biologically or ecologically sustainable. And I guess I'm asking you, do you think they are, or will they have to be dispersed to a degree?
Well, I don't think that anybody knows the answer to that question. Obviously, in some countries and parts of the world, particularly in Latin America, primate cities tend to be enormous and become inefficient and misdirect and misuse social resources. I mean, this occurs for a variety of historical reasons. And of course, you need more balanced growth. In some cases, the countrysides are actually emptying out too fast for the lack of opportunity for poor farmers or farm laborers. At the end of the day, none of us really know what this brave new urban world is going to be like, whether it is sustainable. But it's clear that the two great challenges in all our future are being able to arrest global environmental change, climate change, and deal with its consequences. And secondly, and the two are actually closely related, is to make cities work, is to humanize cities and to take advantage of their enormous potential for being the most efficient way that we can live together, for the creation of public luxury and high-quality public spaces and, for common citizenship.
Well, I'm going to end it there, and if anything, the staggering statistics in your book should startle some people to action. Thank you so much, Mike.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Mike Davis is the author of Planet of Slums. He was in San Diego this morning. I'm Susan Ormiston, and you're listening to the Friday edition of The Current.